2022-0779, State of Ohio versus Miguel Lamont Mills. On behalf of the appellant, Ms. Burrows, good morning.
Good morning, Justice Kennedy. Members of the court, may it please the court, at this time I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Depending on how the phrase sufficient indicia of incompetence is applied, the rule from State versus Bach is circular. If applied in the way the Sixth District did below, that standard means that an appellant is entitled to a competency hearing only if he can already prove his incompetence. This application begs the question and makes the appellate relief recognized in Bach illusory. But that does not mean that Bach must be overruled. Instead, this court can clarify that the sufficient indicia of incompetence standard requires defendants to raise some quantum of proof less than that needed to win a competency hearing on the merits at trial. Mr. Mills proposes that the phrase sufficient indicia of incompetence should mean a quantity of evidence that raises reasonable doubt of the defendant's competence at the time of conviction. Such a rule is the natural counterpart to the preponderance of the evidence burden of proof at a trial-level competency hearing. It leaves the framework of Bach undisturbed. It relies on well-established legal principles, and it brings this court's competency case law into closer alignment with the General Assembly's statutory commands. The Sixth District's decision below demonstrates that the vagueness of the Bach standard will lead and has led to mistakes in these kinds of cases. The Sixth District made three distinct analytical mistakes. First, it treated a Bach question as if it were a summary judgment question, construing every ambiguity against Mr. Mills. Second, it applied the procedures in 2945.37, which applies to trial-level competency hearings, to the question of a competency issue on appeal. And third, it applied the Drope and Dusky standard as if it were a disjunctive standard. If this court clarifies the phrase sufficient indicia of incompetence, those three mistakes won't repeat themselves.
So let me ask you kind of more about the record. So here we have the attorney raises the competency issue. The defendant refuses to get transported for the competency exam. And then it looks like the attorney just drops it. I mean, why didn't the attorney raise it before trial, say, judge, you know, we need to have this competency exam. Judge, he's not competent to stand trial. I mean, put forth any objection to trial starting without the exam. I mean, am I missing something here?
No, Your Honor, you're not missing any facts. I would maybe disagree with the implication of the facts. This court dealt with a very similar fact pattern just this last fall in State versus Huff. Similar questions arose in that oral argument. Why did the attorney not repeatedly raise the issue? The record in that case makes one point on that question, which is the trial court expressed a clear annoyance or indignation to the attorney for raising the issue when the attorney sort of made reference.
Did that happen here?
No, Your Honor, but it is one of many reasons that a trial court defense attorney may not repeatedly object to a motion that's already been overruled. Another reason might be
But here there was nothing overruled. The judge ordered the competency exam. The only reason it didn't happen was because the clients refused to be transported. So,
and this court held
that doesn't seem to really fit this situation.
And this court held in State versus Ware that where a defendant refuses to comply with an evaluation, that does not excuse a trial court's obligation to have a hearing. It's the trial court's obligation to ensure the defendant's competency, as this court held in Lawson. It's not the defendant's to raise the issue repeatedly. Once a critical mass of facts is apparent on the record, the duty shifts to the trial court to make sure that the defendant's due process rights are protected. So respectfully, Your Honor, the fact that Ms. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Have we said that bright line rule that there is a duty shift to the trial court to protect the defendant's due process rights? We have in some issues on other things, but have we said that?
That is how I understand this court's majority opinion in State versus Lawson. I think that that's also clear from the United States Supreme Court cases, Pate versus Robinson, Dusky, and Drope. I think that the obligation does belong to the trial court, and I do believe that that is a settled issue of law.
Well, what stops the trial judge in this case from thinking that counsel no longer thinks it's an issue, since counsel doesn't seem to be particularly concerned about it? The defendant seems pretty capable of understanding the proceedings. It was the defendant, after all, refused to get transported. I mean, it doesn't look like the judge, that the defendant and their counsel is just does no longer thinks competency is an issue.
Yeah. Two answers to that question, Your Honor. One is procedural and one is substantive. I think the clearest statement, contemporaneous statement on the issue of competency from any lawyer who knew Mr. Mills was the motion filed by his defense attorney. That motion is detailed and clear, and it recites the attorney's inability to discuss plea negotiations, the strength of the evidence against him, to even have a conversation with him without devolving into violence. If the court is going to draw any inferences about what Mr. Mills' trial attorney thought of his competence, that motion should speak for itself. That's my substantive answer. My procedural answer is, when the record is ambiguous, we should not be drawing inferences against Mr. Mills. To do so, again, is just to incorporate the summary judgment burden or standard of review in a case like this. And for all of the reasons stated in my brief, the procedural nuances of a case like this, it makes no sense to draw every inference against Mr. Mills in a case where Mr. Mills never had the opportunity to develop facts. So, Your Honor, the state's interpretation of this record is one reasonable interpretation of these facts, but there are two reasonable interpretations. One is that Mr. Mills' behavior indicates he was incompetent. And when you have two conflicting interpretations like that, my proposed rule is that the case must be remanded for a hearing to determine which of the two interpretations is correct.
So if we agree with you, then what happens? It goes back for a competency hearing. If the court finds that he was competent at the time of the trial, then the verdict keeps the verdict. Or if it finds incompetent, then it has to vacate the verdict. Is that what happens?
Respectfully, Your Honor, no. I do not believe that a retrospective competency hearing is appropriate in this case. In State versus Ware, this court reversed the conviction and remanded for a new trial, vacated the conviction. United States Supreme Court precedents, Drope, Dusky, Pate, all of those decisions cast doubt on the value of a retrospective competency hearing. To the extent that there's any daylight in those decisions, that in some cases a retrospective hearing like the one you describe may be appropriate, this is not that case. In Pate versus Robinson, this procedural history was the lower federal court sided with the defendant appellant in that case and remanded for a retrospective hearing. The case then went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court reversed specifically that remedy and held it wasn't appropriate. And in that case, the record in that case showed that Mr. Robinson's family members had come and testified extensively about his lifelong struggles with mental health issues after a brain injury when he was a child. And that record also contained medical records of a 7-week hospital stay at a psychiatric, an inpatient stay at a psychiatric hospital. If that record did not lend itself to a retrospective hearing, surely this one does not.
So I want to go back to that because I have Lawson up, and we actually did cite Drope in it, Hernandez, as well as Stanley versus Cullen. But I took what you said to me as to be a bright line rule, that once it is raised by defense counsel, the duty shifts, the trial court has to have the hearing to protect due process. But when you read Lawson, the trial court didn't. So on appellate review, there was an analysis of whether or not there was sufficient indicia of incompetency in order to determine whether or not the trial court erred in not having the hearing. So which are you saying? That the trial court absolutely has to, it's error, due process error on the rights of the defendant requires an automatic reversal? Because I'm not reading this to say that.
I understand. I thank you for explaining, Justice Kennedy. I think I've been unclear. I do not contend today, and I think this court's decisions foreclose any kind of automatic reversal for failure to hold a hearing. That's what Bach holds, and I agree that that is what Lawson holds. I think practically speaking, the standard in a Bach appellate case should be also contemplated by trial court judges deciding when to have a hearing. I think it's, you know, in the real world practice of law, they would be the same standard. And so, Your Honor, I think to answer your question more plainly, trial courts would be required to hold competency hearings when there is a sufficient indicia of incompetence. There's still that threshold to meet before reversal is appropriate.
Here, I'm glad you got to the practical side. That's what I'm going to talk about. By the fact the defendant wouldn't attend a competency interview or whatever you want to call it, doesn't that limit both the state and the defendant from making any argument about the competency of the defendant?
It's difficult to say, Your Honor. I don't have reason to believe in this record that Mr. Mills would not appear in court for such a hearing. He refused to submit to an evaluation. I'm not sure that he would.
But by not submitting to the evaluation, doesn't that limit both sides' ability to argue his competency, whether it's preponderance or reasonable doubt or whatever?
It would, and the statute makes clear that that works against the defendant in a case like this one. The defendant bears the burden. But this court, again, said in State versus Ware, there are other things to consider. Is there access to previous mental health records? I believe the state will probably get up here and remind the court that Mr. Mills has an extensive criminal record, lots of engagement with the courts. There were steps to be taken in a hearing that would have dispelled some of these doubts. Even discussions.
I read the motion.
Yes, okay. Right.
Was there an affidavit submitted as a proffer?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so.
So all we have on the record is a request for a competency hearing, and we have no evidence submitted.
Your Honor, I would submit that a motion filed by an attorney subject to the rules of professional ethics should receive some weight. It is not an affidavit. It's not made under oath, but there are consequences to an attorney who misstates facts.
But it's not a proffer of evidence. That's my point. It's not evidentiary, and it wasn't a proffer of evidence.
Your Honor, I agree, and the reason that there was no evidence offered in this case was there was no hearing held.
Well, there was no evaluation either.
Agree, that is what the record says here, but I believe, again, this court's precedent is clear that the absence of an evaluation doesn't excuse the lack of a hearing.
What's the rule that you want us to write in this case? Understanding where this court has been in Bach, Lawson, what is the rule that you want us to write?
I would ask this court to clarify the phrase sufficient indicia of incompetence to mean enough indicia that there is a reasonable doubt of an appellant's competence at the time of conviction. And I believe that that rule will not result in a floodgates problem, a slippery slopes problem, because the real effect of that rule, again, in the everyday practice of court, will be to put trial courts on notice that they need to be addressing these issues on the record before an appeal is filed. And this court's holding in State versus Johnson makes plain just how easy it is for a trial court to do that. In that case, an attorney made an oral motion for a competency hearing. The court immediately turned to the defendant and asked a few questions about the charges, sentences, are you able to work with your attorney? The defendant said yes, and this court said that's enough to dispel the doubts that linger on appeal. This is a workable, practical rule that should be familiar to most lawyers. And with that, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Majdalani.
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 Thank you. May it please the court, Madam Chief Justice, my name is Brenda Majdalani, and I represent the state of Ohio and Lucas County Prosecutor Julia Bates in this case. As I see it, there's two basic issues that this court is going to need to resolve. One is whether the failure to hold the evidentiary hearing in this case was harmless error, which we submit it is, and whether this court should adopt the lower reasonable doubt trigger standard that appellant has proposed in their proposition of law. Now, Revised Code 294537 states that the defendant is presumed to be competent, and the burden of proof is on him to show sufficient indicia of incompetency by a preponderance of the evidence. Now, that statute requires that a hearing be held when the issue has been raised at a pretrial stage. But in Bach, this court said that if the trial court fails to hold that hearing for whatever the reason, it can be harmless error when there's insufficient indicia in the record. Now, if you look at the record in this case,
insufficient indicia for what? To determine that the defendant is incompetent or that raises the specter of incompetency?
He has to show sufficient indicia of incompetency. The burden is on him to show that he is incompetent because he has access to those resources and he has the most incentive to produce that evidence.
Okay, and in this case, so he would not do the evaluation.
Right. He refused to leave his jail cell because that's not the direction he wanted his case to go. He made it very plain in his six pretrial appearances, particularly the one in September and I think it was October 23rd, where he kept telling the court and his attorney, I want the soonest possible trial date. He was trying, and he had a very definite trial strategy that he expected his attorney and the trial judge to follow. And he had enough experience with the criminal justice system to know that every date after indictment is another day the state has to compile evidence against me, to go and talk to Mr. Euless, the victim, and to try and convince him to let me take his car door apart to look for a bullet, see if we can find a gun, whatever.
But counsel, you concede that there may be cases where someone refuses to comply with the evaluation and they're really not competent to stand trial. And it may not have been the case in this case.
There could be cases where, yes, somebody refuses to do it because they're frightened or whatever their mental
illness is. They're off their meds.
They're off their meds.
Okay, so.
But that's not this case.
The thing that should have happened in this case is that it was raised. And the trial court should have said, before we start this trial, we have to address what was raised. And that should have taken place.
Well, I don't think that was necessary, and here's the reason why. Because when Mr. Mills stood in his jail cell and basically said by his behavior, I'm not having my competency examined, this is not what I want, he should be deemed to have, at minimum, waived the right that his attorney asserted, or I think even he revoked it.
Is he competent to waive? What if he's not competent to stand trial?
The right is personal to him. It is his due process right to fair trial. And so if he says, I don't want my competency examined, then we can't carry him feet first out of his jail cell and have him do that.
But can a mentally incompetent person do that?
No, but we don't. But again, he's presumed competent by statute unless he shows otherwise. He has to show sufficient indicia. And when you look at the record in this case, the appellant points to all his pretrial behaviors where he interrupted a trial judge when he got upset that his case was continued. Again, he did not want his case continued. But when you look at his trial behaviors, okay, if his right to a fair trial is exactly that, fair trial, then why are we not looking and giving the most weight to the evidence of what he said and did during trial? And if you look from the time that the judge banged the gavel and said, okay, we're now trying this case, we're picking a jury, he had no more issues with defense counsel. All the issues that defense counsel raised in his motion apparently resolved themselves. He didn't interrupt the trial judge during trial. In fact, he participated in voir dire. He was invited into the chambers conference when they were picking the jury, and the judge said to him specifically, now, Mr. Mills, you can say anything you want about picking a jury in this proceeding. And he took the judge up on that, because when the state exercised a peremptory challenge against a juror, what did he say? He said, this is racist. He took the judge at his word, and he was acting in his own defense. If that's not a competent behavior, I don't know what is. Now, we fast forward to the trial. The state's getting ready to introduce the video compilation evidence against him. What does he do? He nudges his attorney and says, hey, wait a minute. I don't think I've seen this video. I'd like to see it before the jury does. So they excuse the jury from the courtroom. They show it to him. He's satisfied. The trial moves on. The defense gets ready to arrest, and the judge goes through the colloquy with him about, you understand you have a right to testify, and if you choose not to testify, nobody can make a comment about that. He answers the court's questions. At no time did defense counsel raise any issue about competency. At no time did he say, hey, judge, I'm still having these issues with my client. The court didn't see any issues. The prosecutor didn't see any issues. So his behavior at trial, he's competent. Now, I watched the oral arguments in the Huff case, and I remember, Justice Fisher, you made the comment that competency is fluid. Well, if competency is fluid, and I believe that's correct, and you can be competent in your pretrial status and maybe develop incompetency during the trial or at the beginning of trial, why is the reverse not true? Even if you want to say Mr. Mills' behaviors raised some issue in his pretrial, which I don't see it. I see that as angry behavior that any ordinary criminal defendant has undergone. I've been a prosecutor for 28 years, and I've seen many a defendant question the wisdom of their attorney, interrupt the trial judge, or whatever. But why are we not looking at his behavior during trial? His behavior during trial screams competency.
But why should we guess, especially when the statute says that it's required? Because no matter how many years an attorney's been an attorney is not a mental health professional, and neither is a judge. And if the statute, in the wisdom of the legislature, says if it's raised, you have to hold a hearing, we wouldn't be trying to satisfy ourselves that we did the right thing.
Well, here's the problem, Your Honor, is the appellant himself is the reason why we don't have a full appellate record. And if Justice Resnick, I believe, in the Ware case, raised this issue in her dissent. She said that there should be some consequence for the defendant. If he refuses to cooperate with the competency hearing, then that should be on him.
Anecdotally, many of us are aware that one of the symptoms of major depression is anger. So how do we know that that wasn't a manifestation of some kind of depression, and maybe by the time we got to the trial, he snapped out of it? But without a hearing, we don't know.
No,
so
but if he's...
Why is that okay? Why is that harmless error?
Because it is a right to a fair trial. If he snapped out of it during trial, it's a right to be competent at trial. Don't misunderstand me. The state has no interest in taking somebody to trial that's truly incompetent.
I understand, but even the question of whether or not to go to trial or to take a plea resides in a necessity for competency as well. So, I mean, I don't know why we want to, after the fact, say, oh, it was okay, or it really wasn't the responsibility of the court and the counsel there to provide a fair trial. I mean, what are we here for then?
I think, Your Honor, I think the reason why there wasn't a hearing was because defense counsel, the prosecutor, the judge, I think everybody understood that when Mr. Mills stood in his jail cell and said, I'm not leaving, that was treated as a revocation of the right. His attorney filed that motion on his behalf, and then I think when he refused to do that competency exam, everybody was under the understanding that, okay, this is not what he wants. He's not going to do it. So it's been dropped. Because certainly defense counsel had the opportunity to bring it up.
But didn't we have to presume he was competent to make that decision? I mean,
the statute says he's presumed competent.
And that's not enough of an indicia, his erratic behavior before trial.
I would disagree with the characterization that it's erratic. Every sane person, even competent person, that in my experience, and I know the trial experience on this bench is much more than my experience, but you take somebody who is competent and who is sane, doesn't have mental illness, if they're upset about the fact that they didn't get out on bond, They interrupt the trial judge. They yell, they scream. I've seen obstreperous defendants get hauled out to the obstreperous room. That's not unusual. But what concerns me is the practical effect, like Justice Fischer talked about, is if this court is going to say, we're concerned about maybe this flood of behaviors that we're seeing in court, and we think that we want more people to be screened and we want more people to receive mental health services, then that decision should come across the street from the Ohio legislature. Then they should modify perhaps the preponderance standard, the trigger standard that appellant talks about.
But don't we have statistics already that say that the percentage of mentally ill people who are in prison in Ohio is higher than what's in the general population? Doesn't that tell you something?
That tells me that there needs to be mental health provision in the jails for the people that are already there. But I don't, what concerns me is that if we're going to adopt this lower trigger standard, we've taken the scales of justice, and we're now going to tip them this way. And if I can give you an analogy a minute, I think this will answer your question. Right now, the standard says you have to show a preponderance. And trial judges are very smart. They all are. And they don't like to be reversed on appeal. And I know I've had a few get upset with me personally for bringing cases up on appeal. So if you're an astute trial judge and you look at the statute and it says I have to use a preponderance standard when I'm evaluating this evidence, and if I find the person competent and then they file an appeal, but on appeal the standard is lowered to reasonable doubt, they're going to do one of two things. They're either going to ignore the statute, and we're going to create this exception that's going to swallow the statute, and they're going to say I have to use this reasonable doubt standard or I'm going to get reversed on appeal. Or they're going to say in their journal entry they're applying a preponderance standard, but not really doing so. Because again, trial judges don't like to get reversed on appeal. So I'm concerned as a practical effect, we're going to create this black hole that's going to suck up not only the courts holding in Bach, but suck up the statute too.
Just so you don't have to hold a hearing?
I think that the trial judges are not trying to avoid hearings, but I think there is certain circumstances where they're under the impression that counsel has either waived it, dropped it, or that the client has waived it and dropped it. And I think that's what happened in this case.
But that could have been clarified in this case. The hearing could have really took 5 minutes. It could have said, let the record reflect. We offered the opportunity to be evaluated. He didn't take advantage of it. I'm going to ask you a few questions, as your opposing counsel said. I'm satisfied that you're competent. Let's call the jury up.
If you're talking about the Johnson case that Ms. Burroughs referred to, if I recall, the court specifically said that that was not a competency hearing. Yes, they went through the questions, but that was not treated as a separate hearing. But
if someone's presumed competent and someone answers the questions, that's all the record the state needs to.
It's true. I mean, they could have asked Mr. Mills, you know, do you want your competency examined? Are you waiving the right? Or, you know, you understand the nature of the proceeding? Yes. But again, the statute says he is presumed competent. And again, it's a right to a fair trial. So I think when we weigh the evidence, we need to look at not only his questionable behaviors, but we look specifically and give more weight to what did he say and do during the trial. He showed that he was quite competent during trial. He cooperated with his attorney. He made statements in his own defense. He spoke up at sentencing and corrected what he felt was the prosecutor's incorrect recitation of his record. The prosecutor says he has a history of violence, and Mr. Mills says, well, wait a minute, I have prior drug convictions. Now, he forgot the fact that he does have a juvenile felonious assault conviction and he had an ag menacing, which are treated as offenses of violence, but he understood that that statement was going to affect his sentencing. He understood the purpose of it, and he spoke up in his own defense. Again, if that's not competency, I don't know what is. So based on this record that you have in front of you, I don't know how you can look at it and say there's any indicia, much less sufficient indicia, of incompetency here.
Do personality disorders result in a person being found incompetent?
I suppose they can, but this court and the federal court's jurisprudence has shown that you can be mentally ill, you can be taking psychotropic medication, and that does not necessarily automatically result in incompetency.
Right. I mean, access to, when I'm talking about, there's not often a lot of medication for that.
No, if you're talking about things like ADHD or Asperger's syndrome, those kind of things, I mean, there is medication for ADHD, but I don't know that the personality disorders necessarily prevent you from understanding the proceedings or cooperating with counsel.
We don't even understand enough about personality disorders, do we?
I wouldn't think so.
Because
they're still discovering, you know, Asperger syndromes and ADHD.
Oh, it's way beyond that, though. The kind of disorders that you see in the criminal justice system, those are minor compared to the other kinds of sociopathic disorders. And so we don't understand enough about them, but perhaps a professional in mental health would understand more, and then it would better help us as attorneys or judges to understand and really make that determination for a fair trial, wouldn't it?
Well, right, and I see my time is up, but if I can give a quick answer to that. My problem with that is mental health professionals are not always able to do that, even though they're trained professionals. And if you look at the Weingartner case that we supplemented as supplemental authority, there was a case where they did do the competency hearing and they had the defendant examined, and the mental health professional came back and said to the court, I can't tell you if this person is competent because I can't determine whether or not they're malingering or genuinely incompetent. Now, the federal case law up to this point has always said, well, the state doesn't have a genuine or legitimate enough interest in preventing malingering defendants from raising these claims. Here's a case where a mental health professional could not make that determination.
And for that reason, we should not hold a hearing.
No, I'm saying that when they stand in their jail cell and they refuse to do the hearing, as the Sixth District said, they should be deemed to have not cooperated with their statutory duty to undergo the hearing. And there should be some consequences for that, as Justice Resnick stated in her dissent in Ware. Thank you.
Thank you. Burroughs. A minute 32.
Thank you, Your Honor. Every fact referenced by the state in its argument pertained only to half of the Dusky competency standard. I think that I would have a tough case arguing that Mr. Mills didn't understand the nature of the proceedings. But that's not the question here. The question is, could he rationally benefit from the assistance of his counsel and aid in his own defense? None of what, or at least most of what the state raised in its argument really addresses that point. And that the Sixth District also overlooked a number of facts indicating that Mr. Mills could not benefit from the relationship with his attorney.
Well, but those weren't really competency issues. I mean, they seemed to have some issues with his attorney, but I think competency goes to, yes, you have to be able to understand the proceedings against you, and because of that, and be able to assist in your defense based on your understanding of the proceedings. It doesn't mean that you have to get along great with your counsel, right? That's not competency. And that's the only thing I see in the record here, is just that he was difficult at times.
Respectfully,
but difficult is different than competent, right?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would draw different inferences from the facts. And again, the question in this case is not, can we draw different reasonable inferences from the same facts, but what happens when we have an ambiguous record like this one? And who should have been drawing those inferences? And it's clear, this court's case law is clear, it's the trial court that needs to draw those inferences once there's sufficient indicia of incompetence. You know, we wandered into some public policy discussions in the state's argument. I would just like to direct this court's attention to the Supreme Court case Cooper. That's a case cited extensively in my brief. And in that case, the United States Supreme Court weighed the interest of the state in speedy resolution of cases against the interests of defendants in fair, orderly due process. And it had no question deciding that when we're discussing delays related to malingering, issues regarding coordinating practitioners, medical professionals, the interests fall in favor of the defendant. With that, unless there are no other questions, I would ask this court to vacate Mr. Mills' conviction and remand this case for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court.